From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
In Britain, attempted terror. In Iran, opportunity. Hello again, I'm Orrin Almy, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. British officials say the same men who attacked Glasgow's airport in a flaming car also rigged two cars to explode in London the day before. Seven people have been arrested in those attacks, two of them doctors. We'll hear more about the investigation and what it could mean for the U.S. Also today, despite a recent crackdown on cultural openness and public dissent, gasoline rationing has caused widespread unrest in Iran. Is this the moment to step up international pressure in hopes of regime change? Or is it an opportunity to approach Iranian moderates who want to help stabilize Iraq and Afghanistan? First, the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. Hawks and doves within the Bush administration are at odds over the opportunities being created by civil unrest in Iran. On To the Point, should the U.S. and its allies get tough in hopes of regime change or approach Iranian moderates about helping to stabilize Iraq and Afghanistan? That's the second half of today's program. First, the aftermath of aborted terrorist acts in the U.K. Two doctors are among the seven arrested in the United Kingdom. Police say they are linked to the two Mercedes cars discovered last Friday in London and to Saturday's attack on the Glasgow airport with the flaming Jeep Cherokee. Here's Gordon Brown's newly installed Home Secretary Jackie Smith addressing Parliament today.
As a government, as communities, as individuals, we need to ensure that the message of the terrorists is rejected. I very much welcome the strong messages of condemnation we've heard throughout the weekend from community leaders across the country. It is through our unity that the terrorists will eventually be defeated.
Mike Evans is defense editor for The Times of London. And Mike, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay.
Talked to you Friday when the first of those two Mercedes had been discovered. Then over the weekend, there was this attack by the Jeep Cherokee, which was in flames, crashed into the airport terminal in Glasgow, but it didn't hurt anybody except the people who were in the Jeep Cherokee. How is it that the authorities say they think these incidents are linked?
Well, there are a number of factors that have made them realize there is a link. First of all, the two Mercedes cars that were used as car bombs in London are supposed to have been parked originally in Scotland and were driven down from Scotland to London for those two plots. So that's one of the factors. They've also got mobile phone records which show that they were traveling down to London, and they've got links between the two incidents, they're pretty strong links.
I've seen reports that some of these people, at least, were under surveillance before these incidents occurred. Is that right?
It's not quite as simple as that. I think what happened was that when the incident happened in the West End in London, the first incident, because the bomb didn't go off, they managed to get a huge amount of material, including mobile phones, etc. And because of that, they were able to trace the people who were responsible back up to Glasgow. And that's why the police up in Glasgow had a little bit of prior notice that possibly there may be something else happening up in Scotland.
So prior notice before the Saturday event, but not before the Friday event.
No, that's correct. And what they didn't have any prior intelligence of an imminent attack on the airport at Glasgow. They just had some indication that some possible targets, there may be some target in the Glasgow area over the weekend.
Seven people arrested. What do we know about them?
Well, we don't know an awful lot. We know that two are doctors. We know that, that they're all probably of Middle Eastern extraction or something like that. One of the first doctors who's been identified is a Jordanian, for example. But over here, legitimately working as a doctor, was registered as a doctor. So we know quite a lot about their background. What we don't know for sure is the nationalities of all seven. I think the security and police authorities are still trying to establish exactly what nationality they have. Very often with terrorist suspects, they have multiple identities, and it's very difficult to be precise about exactly who they are and where they come from.
Talking with Mike Evans, defense editor for the Times of London. Well, what are they saying? What are the police saying about the network that may have connected these people?
I think there's not much doubt in everyone's mind that they have some connection one way or the other to Al-Qaeda. That doesn't mean to say they are fully paid-up members of Al-Qaeda, but as you probably know, there are all kinds of affiliated and sort of franchised groups around the world, and I think these people are obviously radicalized extremists, and they all seem to have an affinity, if nothing else, to Al-Qaeda. It does not mean in this case, and probably not in this case, that they've been, as it were, supervised, masterminded, or authorized to carry out these operations by someone sitting in Pakistan as a member of the Al-Qaeda organization.
Do the police indicate that they are still searching for other people?
Yes, they are. I think after the all these sort of incidents, for example, the July the 5th terrorist suicide bombings that took place in London in 2005. Of course, they knew there were four bombers who were the suicide bombers, but they then discovered quite a large number of other people who were on the periphery of the operation, people who knew about the operation, people who had knowledge of what they were planning to do. So they do scoop up more people in these sort of networks and were arrested after these sort of incidents. So, yes, that's what they're planning to do now. They've got seven so far, and they may well anticipate arresting more people in the next few weeks.
What's the security situation now in London and, I should say, I guess, in England and in Scotland?
The general public, there really isn't that much to notice. I mean, obviously, if you go to an airport, you'll find that you can't drive your car up to this sort of pickup and place right outside the terminal. But apart from that, there isn't any great overt security as far as the public's concerned. There are more police at railway stations and things like that. But I think most people, certainly in London and Glasgow, are carrying on their normal business.
Again, we're talking with Mike Evans, who is defense editor for the Times of London. We'll be back in a moment to talk about more about what's happening in the UK and also about increased vigilance here in the United States on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman Only back with To the Point, talking today about the aftermath of two aborted terrorist attacks, bombings in London on Friday, and then the latest incident at the airport in Glasgow on Saturday. Secretary of Homeland Security Michael Chertoff says he's seen no recent intelligence about a specific plot against the U.S. The terror alert level has not been raised, although security has been tightened on air travel and on public transit. That's in advance of the 4th of July. Bobby Block covers Homeland Security for the Wall Street Journal. Bobby, always good to have you with us.
Thanks, Warren.
What are you hearing about any kind of connection between what we've seen in the U.K. over the weekend and what might happen next in the United States?
Well, I mean, one of the things that's happening is happening. One of the plot has a striking similarity to a plot that was dreamed up actually before 9/11 by an Al-Qaeda cell leader called Darin Barot, also known as Abu Issa al-Hindi. And his idea was to pack limousines full of propane canisters and to turn them into bombs. So the minute this plot, and what he'd done is he had a cell come over to New York and case the financial district, the IMF and World Bank headquarters in Washington, and the Prudential Building in Newark. I don't know if you remember that. That was back in 04 that came out. So what ended up happening was when this plot emerged, because of the echoes that it had to the previous which plot that never came off, police around the country where the cell had visited, like New York and California, are turning over leads looking to see if there are any individuals that are around. Apart from that, there's no specific information about any plot, but everyone's ratcheting up the security around airports, certain critical infrastructure, just in case something gets through, because the old mantra is you don't know what you don't know.
You said that this Al-Qaeda leader came over to the United States. Where did he come over from?
Well, he actually didn't. He had a cell that was working for him, and he sent them over from the UK. It was under the orders of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was the operational commander and the mastermind behind 9/11. And they were in the process of looking at alternate plots. And the plot was to take out the World Bank, the financial institutions in New York City, as well as the Prudential Building in New Jersey. So they sent people out to case them. And what we know about this, because in 2004, an operative computer had been seized in Pakistan, and he was coordinating information between people outside of Pakistan and the leadership of al-Qaeda in the hills of the Northwest Frontier Province and in Afghanistan. And on this computer, they had all the details about the plot, including pictures of the garages and places around the financial institutions. And one of the documents was called the Gas Limo Project, and it envisioned stacking propane cylinders and putting them in a garage and detonating them and bringing the buildings down. And while he were here, I mean, New York NYPD has had a full-time detective on this case since it was first discovered in 2004, turning over every possibility in every place they stayed and every connection the cell made, and they're still doing that.
Bobby Block, Homeland Security correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Let me go back briefly to Mike Evans, the defense editor for The Times of London. Just interested if this man is well known to people in London and if they're examining that same connection.
Yeah, it sure is. And the connections are so dramatically blatant that I think people do think that there may be some sort of connection, not necessarily with this man, Barot, but certainly with his plan. I mean, I think it was thought probably by al-Qaeda that this was a very good plan, and maybe they're trying to reinstate it now that Barot, of course, is serving a life sentence in prison. Barot, by the way, does have huge influence in the prison where he is, and he's been transferred relatively recently because of his influence.
Influence with other prisoners, you mean?
Yeah, exactly, trying to radicalize other prisoners. I think the prison service are really quite alarmed by this. So this is a guy who did have huge influence, and I think his plan may well have been reinstated by these people here. Whether they've had any particular connection to Barot or not is difficult to tell. But, yeah, the security authorities are certainly looking at this connection. They're not seeing it as the sort of, you know, the definitely plan two, as it were, but they are looking at the connection.
Mike Evans, again, defense editor for The Times of London. Thanks so much for being with us today. Bobby Block, back to you with The Wall Street Journal. So this is maybe another incident where al-Qaeda, failing at a given effort in one place, has simply tried the same thing again. So that computer found in Pakistan has turned out to be pretty useful.
Well, yeah, I mean, al-Qaeda is known not to abandon targets, especially when it has so much rich information and ideas. However, in this particular case, the original Barot's original idea was to use this kind of bomb in an enclosed place. And he specifically said if you would use it outdoors, it would not work because it required gasoline as well, and people would smell it, and the effect in the outdoors would not be as great. So apparently, if indeed this plot was inspired by this project, they goofed because they left it outside, and it was the smell of gasoline and the smoking in the car that tipped off authorities to the fact that something was wrong, and then they discovered the bomb and defused it.
Bobby Block again, the Homeland Security correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Also joining us is Bob Ayers. He is security expert at London's Chatham House. That's an international policy think tank. And Bob Ayers, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
What do you make of all this? You haven't heard all of our conversation, but you certainly know the background that we have discussed, including the Gas Limo Project. And what do you take away from what's happened in Britain over the past few days?
Well, in the simplest sense, we've had a very well-organized and coordinated series of attacks over several hundred miles, all simultaneously. And it's only been through what is, in effect, pure luck that we haven't had mass casualties in this country.
Pure luck. What about the apparent inability of the plotters to carry out their attempted attacks?
Well, let's talk about that. Inability of plotters. You had two plotters pack cars full of petrol, explosive propane gas, igniters, drive them in the center of London, park them by a heavily occupied nightclub in the middle of the night, and walk away from the cars and leave them there ready to be detonated, that's not incompetency. That's very competent. Now, what we don't know is whether or not the reason the cars in London did not explode is whether or not there was a misfire in the firing mechanism itself, or whether they were on a timer and the time hadn't arrived yet to set them off. And if it wouldn't have been for some emergency services people, in U.S. talk, that's ambulance service people, that had showed up in London to treat somebody in the nightclub that was sick, they wouldn't have even discovered the bomb there.
What about... Go ahead, excuse me.
Okay, and the other car bomb in downtown London, you know, it's inconceivable, but if you think about this, they had the local towing service working for the local council come hook the car up with a bomb on it and tow it off to the impound yard and towed it out of the area where the bomb was supposed to go off. And it wasn't until after the original car was determined to have a bomb in it, hours later, that somebody went out and looked in the car in the lot and said, wait, the one we've impounded has got a bomb in it too. So, you know, it's luck. There was no intelligence. There was no prior awareness on the part of either the intelligence services or the police. It was all luck that we didn't have casualties in London.
What about the attack in Glasgow, apparently by at least two of the same people also, which went awry, although here was this burning car coming toward the terminal in the Glasgow airport. Luck there, too?
Well, let's talk about that. We had a car that crashed into the entrance to the terminal in the Glasgow airport. In that car was cans of petrol, gasoline to the U.S. vernacular. In that car were compressed gas cylinders full of propane gas. The car crashed into the area, it burst into flames. The car was burning furiously. It was beginning to reach the temperature at which the propane gas cylinders would either burst or ignite, when because it was at an airport with emergency services vehicles close by, they were able to get fire trucks and put water on it and cool it down and avoid the explosion. Now, that's a matter of literally minutes between having a fire and some damage and a major explosion and perhaps many people dead.
Very close calls, then, in all cases. What does this tell us about the future?
We're going to have more of it. We're going to have more of it. The circumstances that gave rise to it haven't changed. The infrastructure that identifies these people, that recruits them, that proselytizes them, that trains them, that in some cases fund them, that infrastructure is still in existence. It's not limited to the UK. It's transnational. And it's always easy to recruit one or two more people to go off and kill themselves.
Can you describe a little bit more about the network itself, and particularly some of the suspects involved to the extent that we know about them? One of them, apparently, a 27 or 26-year-old neurosurgeon, a man who, according to CNN, was at the top of his medical class in Jordan, just came to Scotland not that long ago. He and his wife have had a child there. What could possibly be behind a person like that getting involved in a situation like this?
Well, first of all, two of the people that have been arrested are doctors. One's an Iraqi, the other's a Jordanian. And we have to recognize that what motivates these people to these terrorist acts is not, as popular opinion would have, that they're economically disenfranchised and they're isolated in the community. That's not the reason. They don't do this because they have an objection to the way the country they're living in is run. They do this because they embrace a radical ideology that transcends nation states. And you can be a person that embraces this ideology and be a blue-collar worker. You can be a scientist. You can be a doctor. It's fundamentally an ideological cause that they're embracing, not because of economic disenfranchisement. So you can have a doctor that believes in this, just like you can have a doctor that's a Republican in the United States, or you can have a doctor that's a Democrat. There's a cause that they identify with. In this case, they're identifying with a very radical Islamic cause.
Well, once again, thank you very much for joining us. I know you need to take off.
Yes, I do. Thank you.
Bob Ayer, security expert at London's Chatham House. Let me go back to Bobby Block, still with us, Homeland Security correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Pretty bleak picture being painted by Bob Aris, just interested in whether American specialists in this kind of thing would agree with what we just heard.
Well, I mean, everyone recognizes that Britain has a particular problem, and that is one of alienation and anger amongst a population of Muslims, particularly those coming from the subcontinent of Pakistan and Central Asia. We don't have the same problem. We don't have the general feeling is that there are different immigration and cultural contexts that are here in the United States. There's a concept of an American dream that keeps people working. There's no dole. There's no welfare that people, when unemployed, can collect. So that people are busy trying to achieve here, and that by and large Muslims in this country do achieve. So they're not as frustrated and angry. Now that's what the convention holds. At the same time, there is a concern of what they call homegrown terrorists. And Britain uses the concept of homegrown terrorists usually to mean people who were born or have some citizen status in the UK. When we use homegrown over here, it tends to mean self-selecting, self-radicalizing, self-directing people. And that is a concern. There's no doubt about it, however, that this international jihadism is not showing any signs of abating, and it is growing in strength in various parts around the world.
Well, what about these people we just heard described, doctors, apparently successful ones, from, in this case, Jordan and, I gather, Iraq. In the other case, Iraq could be a different case, obviously, than Jordan, but not people, according to what we just heard, who would fit into the usual category of those who were alienated either as immigrants or under the homegrown category that you just mentioned.
Right. Well, I mean, the thing is that, you know, there it's very funny. I mean, I think I saw something the other night on one of these comedy shows where a woman was saying that her parents came to from Nigeria where, you know, let's go to a land of subtle racism. I mean, just because you're successful does not necessarily mean you don't feel alienated. Mm-hmm. Secondly, you have had in the UK and in Europe in general many more radical preachers and people connected to international jihadism who had for years been openly preaching and had been tolerated by European authorities, partly on the ground that if they operated openly, it would be possible to keep tabs on them, which indeed they did. The problem was it was more difficult to keep tabs on all their followers. And so there are various factors that are operating here. Luckily, so far, we've escaped it. Does it mean that we will escape it tomorrow? Does it mean that there are not people here with similar sentiments who would be willing, if given the opportunity, to carry out something similar? No, it doesn't. But right now, we're not. The problem is constant in the UK and has been so for the past 2 years.
We just have about 15 or 20 seconds left. Are we going to see, though, more stepped-up security in the United States this summer?
Well, I mean, there's no doubt about it that every time there's a threat overseas, there's a reaction here. And I think that we're going to continue to see that. And as this threat, this attack evolves, we'll see the security steps here evolving.
Bobby Block, as always, Homeland Security correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Many thanks.
You're welcome. Thanks.
In a moment, civil unrest in Iran, an opportunity for the West to get tough, or something else. On To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warman Alney back with To the Point. For the past several weeks, the government of President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has cracked down on signs of cultural openness and dissent in Iran. Because of his increased efforts to enrich nuclear materials, the U.S. and some of its allies have been threatening international sanctions. Last month, Ahmadinejad raised gasoline prices by 25%, and last week, without advance notice, he instituted gasoline rationing. Demonstrators set fire to at least a dozen gas stations in Tehran, and they chanted slogans against Ahmadinejad. Banks, supermarkets, and fire engines were attacked as well, and there are reports of trouble in other big cities, too. Borju Daragahi is Middle East reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He speaks to us today from Cairo. Borju Daragahi, good to have you back with us.
It's a pleasure.
Has the unrest continued since the imposition of rationing?
It has not continued. It has died down. You know, in Iran, there are these periodic riots that erupt, mostly on the outskirts of Tehran and in the smaller cities. They're usually over economic matters, the various economic pressures that the people are under.
Has there been, do you think, a negative response to the crackdown on dissent, which we've talked to you about at length on our program before?
I think that there has been among the public, there's been a real negative response. But the government is really strong, and their instruments of basically cracking down on people are very, very effective. And so people tend to just kind of swallow it to some extent. And it's really the economic issues that get a rise out of people.
Are people worried about the possibility of sanctions because of the increased nuclear materials enrichment?
I think, in fact, that they are very worried, and I think the government itself is worried. I think that's one of the reasons why they instituted gas rationing. Iran imports at least 40% of its refined petroleum products. That's a real vulnerability. Ahmadinejad has been riding high on the weakness of the U.S. in the region and high oil prices. That's his one Achilles heel, is the mismanagement of the economy and the various dysfunctions that produces in terms of the overuse of various resources, the tremendous expenditures on really unnecessary things like subsidies for fuel and other basic needs.
And why is it that a nation with so much in the way of oil reserves has to import gasoline?
It's basically because over the last 28 years, since the 1979 Islamic Revolution, there's been very little effort to revamp and improve refining capacity. You know, this is a kind of nuts and bolts stuff, kind of oil industry stuff, but it's actually not that easy to have a energy infrastructure like that. It turns out you not only need to have a lot of crude oil, you need to have a lot of pipelines to take that crude oil into the refining plants. It's a complicated, expensive process, and the government simply has not invested in it.
Now, you say that there's great unhappiness with the government at the moment, but over the weekend there was a significant endorsement of the government's policies, was there not, from the Supreme Leader?
Well, I mean, they're cut from the same cloth to some extent. The Supreme Leader and President Ahmadinejad, both, although one is a ranking cleric and the other is a war veteran from a more modest background, they're both cast from the same ideological die. And so it was really a question of nuance. Does Khamenei, the Supreme Leader of Iran, support Ahmadinejad's hardline faction or more moderate factions that are in the sort of loyal opposition who are part of the Iranian system? And it appears that he's backing the most conservative elements.
And how moderate are the moderates?
Well, I think that, they're a little bit more relaxed on the cultural issues. They would like to, and the key is with foreign policy, they'd like to open up a lot of the moderates to the West, would like to be less ideologically fervent, adopt what some call the China model, whereby you have economic growth and economic openness, but still a lot of political repression.
Again, Borju Daragahi is Middle East correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Ilan Berman is vice president for policy at the American Foreign Policy Council. That's a think tank in Washington. He's editor of a new book, Taking on Tehran, Strategies for Confronting the Islamic Republic. Ilan Berman, good to have you with us.
Oh, good to be back.
You have argued that we ought to take advantage of what unrest there is in Iran and that this is a good moment to do that. What do you think we ought to do, and why should we do it now?
No, I think that's exactly right. Just to amplify a little bit on what Borzu said, the real Achilles heel of this regime in Tehran is this intersection between poor economic statist economic practices and a dependency on foreign refined petroleum. Right now, a gallon of gasoline in Tehran runs about 38 cents, 40 cents.
That's with subsidies.
Because of subsidies. It's essentially what the regime does to give back to the people. But at the same time, even though they're a major oil exporter, they import 40% of their refined petroleum. They essentially use oil much more as a strategic commodity abroad than they would to essentially feed their own population's energy needs. And that means that when you apply the type of economic pressure that the international community is considering, the regime can really only do one of two things. And as you mentioned, they're doing both of them. They're raising prices, and they're beginning to limit their population's access to energy. So this tells you something about the vulnerabilities of the regime and what levers can be used by the international community to pressure the regime to understand that the international community is very serious about curbing Iran's nuclear program.
The international community consisting of the U.S. and who else is on our side in this regard?
Well, that's a very good question, because right now the United Nations Security Council is in the process of deliberating a third tranche of sanctions. We've already had two rounds of fairly unsuccessful sanctions that have really not hammered home the point to Tehran that there are costs associated with their nuclear program. So this gasoline rationing comes very much ahead of that, and with an eye towards that. What the regime is essentially doing, in no uncertain terms, is it's attempting to inoculate its population preemptively so that if there are serious sanctions that come out of the Security Council, their population is less likely to revolt or to react violently to them.
Now, are you of the opinion that if, in fact, pressures of the kind you describe are, in fact, imposed, that will lead to regime change in Iran?
Oh, I think regime change is a very hard thing to determine, as we've discovered all too well. I would say, though, that the regime in Tehran has been very, very good at monopolizing the debate over nuclear energy in its country. They really haven't had an accurate accounting, transparent accounting of what the costs are, potential costs, economic or even military, could be for the Iranian people if the regime proceeds down the path that it's on. And so measures like this, like imposing greater sanctions, like, for example, a gasoline embargo, which has been discussed certainly here in Congress, can really hammer home the point that there are costs involved and divide the Iranian people and sort of inject some doubt into their calculus that this is a good idea moving forward.
Ilan Berman at the American Foreign Policy Council. Selig Harrison is director of the Asia Program at the Center for International Policy. That's also a Washington-based think tank. And Selig Harrison, good to have you back on our program.
Yes, nice to be with you.
What's your take on the strategy suggested by Ilan Berman at this point?
Well, I think he has things turned on its head. The week I just spent in Tehran, I found that it is U.S. Pressure, and both in the form of sanctions and also in the form of a regime change policy, which includes covert action that is now going on against the regime, CIA and Pentagon covert action. And that is what's helping Ahmadinejad. I mean, he's certainly, as has been said, is suffering from his mismanagement of the economy. The rationing just illustrates this, and he's quite vulnerable. And we should have our eye on the ball, which is the March 2008 parliamentary election, the presidential election coming up in the spring of 2009. I found the forces, the moderate political forces referred to, led by former President Rafsanjani, growing in strength. But the one thing Ahmadinejad has going for him, and which undermines the forces we would like to see prevail in Iran, led by Rafsanjani, is this picture of U.S. Pressure, which takes on ridiculous extremes. I mean, the Undersecretary of the Treasury, Stuart Levy, in Dubai on March the 7th, made a speech urging the Arab traders in Dubai, who are making millions in their trade with Iran, not to deal with Iran. And he threatened reprisals against those who do. We've carried this sanctions policy, the covert action policy, to an extent that it just gives all the bad guys in Iran the weapon that they need, and it undermines our other objective, not only the objective of we should have of trying to strengthen the moderate political forces, but also we need Iran's help in Iraq and Afghanistan. The only way the United States can limit the damage in Iraq and in Afghanistan, in situations both of which are getting worse and worse, it seems to me, and are going to continue to do so, is if Iran, which wants to help us, wants to stabilize both the situation in Iraq and situation in Afghanistan for its own interests, has a stake in cooperation with us. They're certainly not going to cooperate with us, and they made this very clear to me, if we are attempting to bring about regime change, if we are attempting to put the economic squeeze on them. So I think we're pursuing policies that are directly opposed to our interest in Iran.
Very different approaches, obviously, from Selig Harrison and Ilan Berman. Let me ask one more question of Borzou Adaragahi. The Ayatollah, the supreme leader, when he spoke out in favor of the policies, the hardline policies of Ahmadinejad this weekend, did not, nor has Ahmadinejad addressed what I understand is a new initiative from the Security Council that if, in fact, they will at least pause in the enrichment of uranium, that there won't be then any sanctions from the Security Council. Is that right? And if so, how significant is it in this debate?
Well, I think it's a proposal that the Iranians are taking seriously. It is a face-saving out, so to speak. You can kind of back down and let things cool a little bit without escalating sanctions, while at the same time not looking like you're backing down to Western pressure or American pressure. I think one thing that's really interesting, and I should say I actually had a great conversation with Selig Harrison in Tehran. We met at a hotel, and we were kind of having a very kind of interesting conversation there. But I think one thing that's really, really a shame, actually, is that after Guantanamo, after Abu Ghraib, after Iraq, the U.S. doesn't have the authority to put the kind of pressure on Iran that maybe it did 5 or 6 years ago. It doesn't have a leg to stand on. Meanwhile, Europe does have that leg to stand on. It does have that authority, but they don't want to. They want to continue selling refined petroleum to Iran and continue making deals with them.
All right. Well, Borzou Adaragahi, once again, the Middle East correspondent for the Los Angeles Times in Cairo today. Thanks a lot for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
Ilan Berman, let me get back to you on this American Foreign Policy Council. What about the fact that the U.S. Has, by all accounts, lost the kind of clout that it might take to accomplish the objective, or at least the strategy, I should say, that you've proposed?
Well, no, I think Borzou has it exactly right. The real tragedy in all this is that we who are more or less seized of the problem of a nuclear Iran or a nearly nuclear Iran have very little leverage over actually being able to shape the regime's responses. It's very clear from sort of watching what Iran is doing in Iraq and in Afghanistan and in other places, Central Asia, for example, that they are quite sure that there is no robust American response forthcoming. This is very different from where we were 3 years ago, where Iran was concerned that they were going to be next on the hit parade, so to speak. So what Iran is doing now is a function of the fact that they really feel like there is no U.S. response forthcoming, whereas Europe is, as Borzou said, much more commercially minded. Europe has enormous leverage over Iran, potentially. In the economic sphere, countries like Italy, countries like Germany, are major trading partners with Iran, and if they began to change their model of business as usual, the Iranians would sit up and take notice, but they're not so far.
Let me go back to Selig Harrison with the Center for International Policy. Why would the Iranians want to help stabilize Iraq and Afghanistan, as you pointed out? There have been reports from the Bush administration that, in fact, Iran is doing various things to make life more difficult in Iraq.
Well, in the first place, in Afghanistan, they were extremely helpful. They don't want the Taliban, a Sunni movement, to come to power in Afghanistan. And they helped us in very important ways militarily and diplomatically to defeat the Taliban, to set up the Hamid Karzai government. And as chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee of the Parliament said to me, our reward was membership in the Axis of Evil. So their interest in Afghanistan, which also, of course, includes narcotics. I mean, this is a very serious problem, the opium and narcotic smuggling out of Afghanistan, and the Iranians suffer from that. It creates tremendous social problems in Iran. So they are very. There's no question about Afghanistan. In the case of Iraq, it is certainly true that they are involved in the support of the Shiite militias in Iraq. But they are. They say that they want to see a stable Iraq because chaos on their borders will definitely cause all kinds of problems for them. They have a long, very long border with Iraq. It's a porous border. It's hard to police. In all kinds of ways, they want to see a stable Iraq. They don't want to see a Sunni-dominated Iraq, of course, but they certainly are prepared to compromise on the character of a Shiite-dominated Iraq that does emerge. And they've offered to take part in the training. You know, there were a very important dialogue that took place in Baghdad on the 28th of May between Iran and the United States. It was the first dialogue the two countries have had, formal dialogue since the hostage crisis. Right now they're pushing for a second round. But the U.S. is somewhat reluctant, it seems, to go in to set a date and to go forward with this, because the Iranians are asking for a quid pro quo. One of the leading editors in Iran said to me, you know, the U.S. is in the position of a fox caught in a trap in Iran, in Iraq. Why should we help you to help to free the fox so that he can come and have us for dinner? Meaning that we are carrying on covert action now, that they think that unless we're prepared to stop the covert action, engage in gradual movement toward diplomatic recognition, that it isn't in their interest to help us in Iraq. But if we're willing to change our policy, then they have a stake, to answer your question, in helping us to stabilize Iraq, because they want good relations with the United States for all kinds of economic and other reasons. And I could say some things about the nuclear issue that haven't been said yet in terms of the terms that they're willing to accept for them. But I think the point on Iraq is that we're using it as a base for espionage in Iran, for sending units of this paramilitary group called the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, the MEK, which is a group on the U.S. State Department terrorist list, which at the same time we're helping, we're sponsoring for various CIA objectives in Iran. They don't want this group to. There are almost 4,000 paramilitary forces in the MEK camps near the border of Iran, and they consider it very important to get this group dismantled, because it's the only militarized opposition.
Okay.
To the regime.
Once again, Zelig Harrison is with the Center for International Policy. We're going to take a very brief break and come back in a moment with Laura Rosen of the Washington Monthly, who has reported that the kind of dialogue that we are hearing on this program is going on within the Bush administration. We'll talk about that in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Warman Ali back with To the Point, to talk today about Iran and how the U.S. might best take advantage of the weaknesses and vulnerabilities of President Ahmadinejad. Laura Rosen is national security correspondent for the Washington Monthly, also contributes to the National Journal, and she's a senior correspondent for the American Prospect as well. And Laura Rosen, good to have you back on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Is what we're hearing, the argument here between Ilan Berman and Zelig Harrison, going on within the Bush administration? And if so, who's ahead?
I think the regime changers have kind of been overshadowed the past year, probably, by those at mostly the State Department who are saying, you know, the U.S. should work with allies and other countries to use tough diplomacy, coercive diplomacy, to pressure this current Iranian regime to change its behavior, both on the nuclear front and in terms of what's been discussed about its efforts to support insurgent groups in Iraq and elsewhere.
What's the evidence that the regime changers, as you call them, have been overshadowed?
I think the people associated with that position, many of them have left the administration, especially in the past year. There was John Bolton, the ambassador to the United Nations, who left. There were several people at the Pentagon. And you've seen Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State, you know, clearly state in recent interviews that behavior change is the policy. And in fact, what's been discussed earlier, this hour, are lots of signs that perhaps the pressure the international community is bringing to bear may be worrying the regime. Maybe, you know, the regime does seem quite concerned about a possible third round of economic sanctions, and they may be taking actions to try to forestall the effects on their own population. And so, you know, it is that kind of calculus, that political calculus, that in the minds of the Iranian policymakers that this administration is trying to affect.
How would what we just heard from Selig Harrison of the Center for International Policy, do you think, go down with the State Department? The idea that if we talk to the moderate forces, there's a chance that we might be able to get them to help us with the stabilization of both Iraq and Afghanistan. And would they be willing to go along with the kind of quid pro quo, he says, the Iranians want to having to do with this?
The MEK.
Yes, particularly the MEK.
I checked in with the State Department today, just in advance of the show, and they are talking about another meeting in Baghdad with the Iranians and the Americans talking about, you know, securing Iraq. But they said there were no details yet on when that might happen. That track seems to be being conducted separately from the UN Security Council plus Germany track, which is focused on trying to change Iran's behavior on the nuclear program. And I think Iran has been, Selig could speak to this more than I think Iran would like to have a discussion that would cover all of these different areas, and the U.S. has been withholding that and has very much been, you know, if we talk to Iran in Iraq, it's only about Iraq, that's not the nuclear issue.
Let me go back to Ilan Berman at the American Foreign Policy Council. What's your take on the idea that we ought to stop supporting the MEK, the paramilitary group, which is already on the terrorist list of the State Department anyway?
Well, I think that's an interesting question because there's an awful lot of heat about in the discussions in Washington about the MEK, but there's really precious little light. I have yet to see concrete proof that the Pentagon is engaged in running the MEK, so to speak. There are certainly reports, more colorable reports, about the use of a different group called Jundullah, which is a Sunni radical Islamist group affiliated with al-Qaeda, which is equally imprudent in my opinion, but I certainly haven't seen much by way of the MEK. But I would like to sort of point out one thing that I was listening to a fascinating discussion that you were having with Selig, but I just want to point out there's an article in the Associated Press today, the Agence France-Presse today, which talked about Iranian positions towards Afghanistan, and I think it didn't track quite with what Selig was saying. In fact, there are Afghan officials who say that Iran is engaged in a diplomatic charm offensive with the Afghan government, but at the same time is providing arms to insurgents, and by the way, Sunni insurgents, that are fighting the government. So I think that the Iranian policy towards Afghanistan might be a little bit more complex than simply trying to make friends with Afghanistan and stabilize the country.
Two questions then to Selig Harrison. First, what's the evidence that the State Department, or the Pentagon rather, is supporting the MEK? And secondly, what about the charm offensive and the double standard, I guess you should say, with regard to Iran in Afghanistan?
Well, first of all, the most important covert action that is being supported by the Pentagon, by special operations units, and by the CIA does have to do with the Jundullah, which is a Baluch group. The Baluch are an ethnic group in eastern Iran which overlap the border of Pakistan. Altogether, there are about 8 million of them in the two countries. And because they overlap, it's easy to get weapons, money across, laundered in ways that are hard to make it hard to get the kind of proof that he is talking about. But I have been tracking the Baluch for about 30 years. I wrote a book about them, and I have a lot of Baluch contacts. And some of them have told me things that make it absolutely clear that we are, that the Jundullah is being helped by the United States. And I think that's the point to be made about what Lara Rosen said. Of course, I she's quite right. The people who wanted to bomb the Natanz nuclear sites, including Mr. Bolton, aren't as, that point of view is now narrowed down to the vice president's office. It appears from what David Sanger writes in the New York Times now and then, but the policy, the covert action operations have a momentum of their own. They've been underway. It's very hard to roll these things back. It's certainly hard to produce the kind of smoking gun evidence that all of us in this discussion would like.
Let me go back to Laura Rosen. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we're almost out of time. I want to give her another opportunity here. You said you spoke with State Department people today. What about the efforts by the Iranians to to talk? And is there any likelihood that there might be a change in American policy there, that we might see more meetings anytime in the near future?
I think on a U.S.-Iran meeting in Iraq, I think is a possibility. They just said there are no details on when, you know, when exactly that would take place.
But only on Iraq?
Only on Iraq. And, you know, today there was in the news additional reports that the U.S. says that there was a Hezbollah, you know, an Iranian-trained Lebanese Hezbollah figure who they've captured in May in Iraq, who was training, I guess, Shiite insurgents in Iraq that have conducted attacks against coalition forces. So the rhetoric continues, you know, and I take it there's a dispute over every single one of these facts the administration produces.
Got it. Elon Berman, should there be any concessions by the United States to Iran?
Well, I think it's important to understand that Iran does have legitimate security concerns in the Persian Gulf. I think those are actually changing very rapidly because Iran is engaged in a pretty aggressive and pretty ambitious strategic offensive in the region. Iran is building its ties to countries in Central Asia. Iran is involved in Afghanistan. Iran's involved in Iraq. Iran's involved in the Palestinian territories, as we found out over the last couple of weeks. I think Iran certainly has legitimate security concerns, but the areas where these legitimate concerns rub up against what the U.S. is trying to do in the region are becoming more and more frequent. And the U.S. and the Bush administration and the U.S. government really has to square clear, coherent, tangible policy.
That's all the time we have. Elon Berman, Laura Rosen, Selig Harrison, thank you very much for being with us. And Borju Daragahi, our earlier guest as well. Today's program produced by Katie Cooper with Dan Konecki, Andrea Brody, and Carmen Radziner. Our technical director, Mike Newport. I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live in podcast as a production co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.